room. It was as if he were God and she were Eve at the moment of creation. Almost completed, she stood there waiting for the next stroke of creation. Wait a minute, I thought. Just how is every woman's life created? How much of my life did I allow to be painted into existence by church, culture, and male attitudes? Down deep, was my life as woman self-conceived and self-created, as an original and unfolding work from my own hands? Or was it contrived according to hidden blueprints? Carolyn Heilbrunn has written about the scripts for womanhood that are handed to women to live out, culturally defined scripts that are written in advance and passed to females from birth. And historian Gerda Lerner writes that men and women live on a stage, acting out their assigned roles. The play can't go on without both of them, she says. But the stage set is conceived, painted, and defined by men. Men have written the play, have directed the show, interpreted the meanings of the action. They have assigned themselves the most interesting, the most heroic parts. By blindly following the script, we tend to become what Ursula K. Le Guin calls male constructs, or, in Madonna Kolbenschlag's words, formula females. It is sort of like filling in a paint-by-number canvas, creating ourselves within the outline of stories, wishes, and mindsets projected onto us by a faith and culture that have been shaped and regulated by men. By blindly following the script, we forfeit the power to shape our own lives and identities. I studied Magritte's painting. It all went back, of course, to Adam and Eve, to the idea of woman being fashioned out of man or out of the male rib. If woman was formed from man in his image to be his helper, then her life and roles emerged from him and revolved around him, or so said this mindset. Sandy moved on to the next painting, but I remained. After a while, he came back. "What's so fascinating about this one?" he asked. "I was just wondering, when it comes to my life, who holds the brush?" He looked at the picture, then back at me. I hadn't said much to him about my awakening. I knew how uncomfortable, how resistant he might be. But standing in the middle of the museum, I told him a little of what was happening to me, that I was experiencing an awakening, that this awakening was spiritual, and that it was feminist. There was a long pause. That may have been the first time I used the word feminist out loud in relation to myself. Along the way, I'd decided that I cared passionately about the essence behind the word, that being a feminist was nothing more than aligning myself with the cause of equality and justice and fullness of personhood for women. "Feminist?" he asked. I nodded. "Well, I guess that will be okay," he said, sounding a little like he was talking to a teenager who'd just asked to take the car out for the first time, sounding too like he was trying to convince himself. Then he asked me where I wanted to go for dinner. I felt like I'd been given some kind of permission I hadn't asked for, and then been dismissed. Right then, I finally found the words to tell him why I was fed up. The more I talked, the angrier I got. People were starting to stare, so we left, and I got angry in the taxi. I railed about what had been done to women. He got defensive. He railed back. At some point I realized he'd become a target for my anger, an anger I had kept tightly bottled. It wasn't fair to him, and yet I needed him to hear me. I wanted so badly for him to understand, and I couldn't make it happen. During awakening, volatility often lies just beneath the surface of a woman's relationship with her partner. In our case, it was created by hurt and blaming on my part, fear and resistance on his. Men's resistance often grows out of their fear. Fear that everything is going to change, that women's gain is their loss, that women will turn the tables on them. Men need to become aware, but blaming them doesn't help. It only polarizes. Eventually, I came to see that what's needed is to invite men into our struggle, to make them part of our quest. If Sandy and I had been more sensitive to what lay behind the other's reaction, if we'd picked our time wisely and listened, really listened to the other, we may have avoided such scenes. But frankly, it may not be possible to completely avoid the clash of feelings that accompanies powerful transitions, Sometimes the exchange may be calm and fruitful, but often it's a wild taxi ride. Sandy and I made our peace, but it would be a while before I mentioned my journey again. Flying home from New York, I thought about the painting. I thought about it over and over, in that curious and exotic way that an unteacher appears only when the student is ready. The Magritte painting appeared and opened several revelations to me. First, our lives as women are not always as self-created as we might assume. And second, once we are caught in the pattern of creating ourselves from cultural blueprints, it becomes a primary way of receiving validation. We become unknowingly bound up in a need to please the cultural father, the man holding the brush, and live up to his images of what a woman should be and do. We're rewarded when we do. Life gets difficult when we don't. Back home, I read these words by Jungian analyst Sylvia Pereira. What has been valued in the West in women has too often been defined only in relation to the masculine, the good, nurturant mother and wife, the sweet, docile, agreeable daughter, the gently supportive or bright, achieving partner. This collective model is inadequate for life. We mutilate, depotentiate, silence, and enrage ourselves trying to compress our souls into it, just as surely as our grandmothers deformed their fully breathing bodies with corsets for the sake of an ideal. Over the next few months, I began to probe the feminine scripts that had been imprinted on my life. Gracious Lady. During a visit to my childhood home in Georgia, I bumped into a school friend, and we relived the time during our adolescence when we'd gone to charm school. It was taught by a dramatic woman we called Miss Bell. It was her task to teach us the art of the female life. This involved learning how to set a formal dinner table, use crystal salt bowls instead of shakers, sit in a chair with ankles crossed, walk and pivot in high heels. The beauty pageant walk, we called it. We learned to pour tea, we learned the proper way to take off a summer glove, and we learned a lot of things a lady would never say and do. We discovered how to win boys by letting them open the pickle jar, whether it was too hard for us or not, and by asking boys questions we already knew the answers to. My friend and I recalled these things with a laugh. I was at a luncheon once where the host actually used those crystal salt bowls, I told her. I got confused, thought they were sugar bowls, and spooned salt into my iced tea. When I saw what I'd done, you know the first thing that came to my mind? Miss Bell. I know, my friend replied. She's been looking over our shoulders our whole lives. Later, I came upon Gloria Steinem's oft-quoted line, "We are all trained to be female impersonators." And I thought again about those hours in charm school. Learning to play the gracious lady had started way back there with Miss Bell and probably even before her. In the film Fried Green Tomatoes, Evelyn Couch lives out the gracious lady, though she's a little too dowdy to pull it off in the manner of crystal salt dishes and beauty pageant walks. Evelyn is a proper and passive woman who is forever accommodating and being sweet, trying to do the right thing and meticulously playing by the rules of culture. In her perky curls and lace collars, she uses her girlish charm and laughter to glide past life's unpleasantness. She visits her husband's aunt at the nursing home, bringing candy, and her smile hardly wavers when the old woman throws it and her out of the room. At the grocery store, a young man runs into her, almost knocking her over, and she apologizes. When a driver usurps a parking space she has been waiting for, she courteously swallows back her anger and continues to circle the lot. When she makes a perfect meal for her husband, setting the table with flowers, she sighs but acquiesces when he takes his plate to the chair before the television. In one of the film's more hilarious moments, Evelyn attends a women's consciousness-raising group at the insistence of a friend who hopes it will instill some power into Evelyn. The leader gives each woman a mirror and tells them they are going to explore their femaleness, the source of their strength and separateness, their vaginas. Falling back in her chair, shocked and flustered, Evelyn makes a non-offending exit, offering her girdle as an excuse. Indeed, wearing a girdle is an interesting metaphor of a woman tightly controlled by conventional expectations. It is not until she meets old Mrs. Threadgood that she begins to question the stereotype she's living. No gracious lady herself, Mrs. Threadgood dyes her hair lavender and tells Evelyn stories about a firebrand girl named Tawanda, actually Mrs. Threadgood herself, who never put on airs and who broke every social rule that confined her true female self. Inspired, Evelyn discards the lace collars and the gracious lady constraints. We witness her ram a car that has stolen her parking place, shouting, "Tawanda!" While I don't recommend ramming cars, in lots of ways the energy of Tawanda is the cure for gracious ladies, those children of Miss Bell, whose real selves are suffocating inside strictures of properness, charm, sweetness, and social convention. Church handmaid. One afternoon, during the same visit to my hometown, I drove by my childhood church, speculating on a certain question. What would happen if I brought feminism into my spiritual life? On impulse, I parked the car beside the church and found a side door open. Maybe I was trying to understand why the question I'd asked turned my hands into warm puddles. Maybe I was trying to recapture an attachment to an old pattern of faith I could feel slipping away, to shore it up, to pat it like a child pats a sandcastle at the first hint of tide. I entered the sanctuary, hoping it would purify my doubts, but all I could seem to remember in there were sermons about the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, and especially that devastating sermon about Eve and the chalkboard with the downward-pointing arrows. I wandered into the educational building, found a child's classroom, and sat in one of those miniature chairs. My knees pushed up toward my chin. I felt like Goldilocks in the chair that was too small. I thought how I'd started out in a nursery down the hall. My grandfather and father were both Baptist deacons. My mother taught children Sunday school and headed the social committee, making sure there were platters of food for all our fellowships. My grandmother had given devotionals at the Women's Missionary Union. Growing up, I'd attended this church 3 times a week for services. I think sometimes a childhood place can lean so heavily on your growing up that later, when you are grown, you find it has become part of your internal geography. This church was such a place. But it came to me suddenly and without question that I must leave the Baptist world. I sat still on the little chair and breathed in and out very slowly, taking this in. A goldfish bowl sat on a piano across the room. It was empty of fish and water, but I saw almost immediately the metaphor it represented. For so long, the Baptist world had been both my goldfish bowl and the water I swam in. I'd come to think of it as the whole realm. I'd grown used to seeing everything through that water. It had never occurred to me that it was possible to leave. At a deep level, I'd not known I could make such a large choice. It sounds silly, but at the time, leaving this realm seemed as daunting to me as leaving the goldfish tank might have seemed to a goldfish. I wondered if I could survive outside the safe perimeters I knew so well. And I was not even thinking at that point about taking my leave from the entire church. I wasn't yet thinking about learning how to breathe in brand new spiritual environs, in a feminine realm where the old breathing mechanisms don't work at all. Despite the growing disenchantment women experience in the early stages of awakening, the idea of existing beyond the patriarchal institution of faith, of withdrawing our external projection of God onto the church, is almost always unfathomable. It's that old, "the world is flat" conviction, where we believe that if we sail out on the spiritual ocean beyond a certain point, we will fall off the edge of the known world into a void. We think there's nothing beyond the edge. No real spirituality, no salvation, no community, no divine substance. We cannot see that the voyage will lead us to whole new continents of depth and meaning. That if we keep going, we might even come full circle, but with a whole new consciousness. Operating with the world is flat mentality, I was only thinking at that moment of going over to the Episcopal Church. which seemed to me to be a much larger fish tank. I tried to picture myself explaining to my husband, my family, my friends, that I was exiting the Baptist church. It was way too much for the imagination, not remotely possible. I got up from the too small chair and left. The following Sunday, home again, I returned to my own church. The deacons sat together on the front pews. All of them, I noticed, were men. The ministers, three more men, sat in huge chairs up front. I looked from one stained glass window to another. Most of the figures were men. As the service began, I became acutely aware that every hymn and biblical passage used only masculine pronouns, as if that was all there was. Until then, I had accepted that when it said men and brotherhood, that somehow meant me too. But now, in a place much deeper than my head, I didn't feel included at all. I realized that lacking the feminine, the language had communicated to me in subtle ways that women were non-entities, that women counted mostly as they related to men. Until that moment, I'd had no idea just how important language is in forming our lives. What happens to a female when all her life she hears sacred language indirectly, filtered through male terms? What goes on deep inside her when decade after decade she must translate from male experience into female experience and then apply the message to herself? What does the experience imprint inside her? Does it keep exclusive maleness functioning inside her, at least at the level of experience and symbol? Sitting there, I thought of all the times I'd listened to ministers and Sunday school teachers extol the virtues of women who were subject to men, extensions of men, helpmates to men. Women who lived as pale shadows of their true selves. Women have not only been educationally deprived throughout historical time in every known society, they have been excluded from theory formation, Lerner writes in The Creation of Patriarchy. That is, we've been excluded from creating symbol and myth, from the meaning-making process that explains and interprets reality. This has been particularly true within the church. There, women have reigned in the nurseries and the social halls, but have been mostly absent from pulpits and places where theology, policy, and spiritual meaning are forged. Within the church, women have been more apt to polish the brass, arrange the flowers, put cookies on a plate, clean up, keep the nursery, be led, pass the credit, look pretty, and be supportive. In other words, women have frequently functioned more as church handmaids than religious meaning makers or symbol creators. The church handmaid is a woman who tries to be a good daughter to the church, trying to be everything it wants and expects her to be. Throughout my life, I'd done this without question. Now, sitting in church, I was full of questions. Why was God always the God of Abraham, never the God of Sarah? Why was it often impossible, rare, or difficult for a woman to hold real power in the church? Women had been the largest consumers of church, yet we'd held a vastly disproportionate amount of power compared to our numbers and commitment there. Why had my father always chaired the finance committee and my mother the social committee, even though my mother could manage household budgets and figures with the acumen of an accountant? The congregation stood to sing. Unbelievably, as if all the irony in the world were crashing down at once, the hymn was Faith of Our Fathers. I tried to sing, but I could not open my mouth. It was as if something had given way in my chest. I lowered the hymn book and sat back down. I was fighting tears. Sandy bent down and nudged me. "Are you okay?" he whispered. I nodded, but inside I felt too heavy to move. Until that moment, I hadn't fully understood. I was in a religion that celebrated fatherhood and sonship. I was in an institution created by men and for men. By the time I got home, I felt disbelief that I'd not seen all this before, that the church, my church, was not just a part of the male-dominant system I was waking up to, but a prime legitimizer of it. I was too dazed to be angry. Mostly I felt disillusioned, sad, betrayed. I stood in front of the closet in the bedroom, hanging up my dress, thinking, but women have been so loyal to the church, so supportive. How could it negate and exclude us this way? How had this happened? That afternoon, I opened a book I'd recently brought home, Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex. I read all afternoon. I read how religion had given authority to men. As de Beauvoir put it, religion had given men a god like themselves, a god exclusively male in imagery, which legitimized and sealed their power. How fortunate for men, she said, that their sovereign authority has been vested in them by the supreme being. That night, I couldn't sleep. I slipped out of bed and went to my study. I stood by the window, looking out at the night. The tears I'd suppressed that morning in church finally rolled down my face. The Secondary Partner. I woke one morning and looked over at Sandy, still asleep on the pillow beside me. We had been married for 19 years. I thought about those years when I was a young wife starting my family, how the newly launched women's movement blew by me with hardly a rustle. Instead of meeting with a consciousness-raising group, I attended marriage and family programs at church. There I learned worthwhile things like communication skills. But I also learned a model of relating that unwittingly promoted women's psychological dependence on men and male authority. Women's personal journeys, goals, and quests were encouraged only to the extent that they didn't interfere with those of husband or children. A woman's surrender of herself on behalf of the rest of the family was, and often still is, extolled as the highest virtue. In the world where I'd grown up, marriage for women had meant revolving around men like planets around the sun. As everyone knows, planets don't question their orbits, they just revolve. An enormous gravitational pull holds a woman in this orbit. It comes from finding approval and a sense of identity in her orbit, since finding these things within her feminine self is difficult in a culture where attitudes and conditioning are ranged against her. I leaned up on my elbow and studied the tilt of Sandy's nose. In some way, we did operate as if the husband's life was the sun, while the wife's was the revolving planet. I began to wonder how a woman defies gravity and changes heavenly courses. What would happen if I actually brought feminism into my marriage? Not that Sandy was a dogmatically rigid or authoritarian person. He'd never demanded that I should submit to him. On the contrary, he was kind and fun and loving and shared decision-making with me. His resistance to my journey, which he didn't verbalize so much as I intuited, came from his own fears about how that would change our relationship. I wasn't sure, but I did know one thing. Introducing feminism into the orbits of our life would make me about as popular with my husband as Galileo and Copernicus had been with the Catholic Church. Bringing feminism into my marriage would turn our little universe on its head. Gazing at him, I realized that the model of the revolving wife was an old model of marriage we'd both inherited, one in which the wife holds a key, though secondary, position. It was the model of the secondary partner. In the model of the secondary partner, the woman may run things at home and have her career, her pursuits, and her quests, but there is a gradation of power in the relationship. As Jungian analyst June Singer points out, when a girl is growing up, it is not taken for granted, as it is with boys, that her life and needs will be primary, that she will have access to places of authority and power like her brothers or father. What is taken for granted is that she will find her main source of fulfillment through her husband and family, that she will be secondary to them. A man assumes certain entitlements simply because he's male. For instance, Sandy was entitled to go and come in the world as he pleased. If he had a business trip, he simply went, no questions asked, and lots of times I packed the bag. But if I should have a writer's conference or a speaking engagement, it was a big deal, something that needed to be discussed. How long would I be gone? Could he manage the children without me? What about meals? How many times a day is the dog fed? At times like those, I felt a nebulous guilt for pursuing my own life. When a woman lives out the secondary partner, She tends to believe, not so much consciously but deep inside, that she is there to be of service to her partner. She might become his inspiration, investing herself in his creativity and work, rather than her own. She may become the woman behind the man, the hostess who initiates dinner parties for his associates, the one who makes sure his clients get Christmas cards. In the extreme, she may become completely deferential and adaptable where he's concerned, shaping herself to his opinions, beliefs, and wishes, or, as a friend of mine says, being wax to his flame. While I didn't go quite that far, I realized that I did often look to Sandy for identity approval and validation. I depended on this the way he depended on my being in the self-sacrificing role. Another film comes to mind, this one portraying a 42-year-old London housewife who is living the secondary partner to such a degree it has taken on the overtones of parody. Shirley Valentine opens with the soundtrack singing, "I'd like the chance to be the girl who used to be me." The recurring question in the film is, what happened to Shirley Valentine? Shirley Valentine was her maiden name, the name she had when she lived from her own center, when she was daring and stuffed full of passion for life. Her quest is to recover her essential self, her Shirley Valentine self. With her children grown and her marriage settled into deep, deadening ruts, her existence is like modeling clay, stretching and molding itself to her husband's life. He wants chips and eggs on Monday, steak on Thursday. He wants his wife always nearby to meet his needs, but not too intrusive. She should be just there, available and useful like an umbrella in its stand. When Shirley gets a chance to go to Greece with a friend, she seizes the trip as part of her quest, though her husband forbids her to leave. One night, sitting beside the Greek shore, Shirley thinks to herself, "I've allowed myself to lead this little life when inside me there is so much more." That's where Shirley Valentine disappeared to. She got lost in all this unused life. She meets Kostas, a fun-loving Greek restaurant owner who takes her out on a boat. She tells him that when she was a girl, when she was Shirley Valentine, she used to be daring. She used to jump off the roof. Encouraged by Kostas, she begins to recover this lost self as the two of them jump off the boat into water that, he tells her, is as deep as forever. When the vacation is over, Shirley stays on, working in Kostas's restaurant, waking up with the sea outside her window, soaking up life in the tiny sun-drenched village, learning to laugh and dare again, and gradually reclaiming herself. She blossoms, ignoring all her husband's angry orders to come home. My favorite scene is when her husband arrives in Greece in order to try to reconcile their lives. She waits for him at a table by the sea, watching him trudge up the hill. He passes her, then turns back.
"I didn't recognize you," he said.
"I know," she tells him. "I used to be the mother, I used to be the wife, but now I'm Shirley Valentine." That morning, as I lay in bed watching my husband sleep, I yearned to transform the model of our marriage, to find my unused life, which is the work a secondary partner will need to do. I needed to find the woman I'd left behind and to challenge the conventional orbits of my relationship. But if I did all that, what would happen to my marriage? Could it sustain that sort of transformation? I had my qualms about it. The Many-Breasted Mother. Another blueprint given to women, the Many-Breasted Mother, is one of the more revered. The image came to me as I watched a peculiar sight on the television news, an overwhelmed mother dog nursing a small litter of newborn kittens along with her own brood of pups. The kittens had been brought to her when their mother died. The mother dog lay sprawled on her side, overrun with mouths, some that naturally belonged to her and some that didn't. "Poor thing, all she seems to do all day long is nurse something," said the owner. Women have been encouraged to embrace the all-nurturing, many-breasted role of womanhood as the jewel in the female crown. And while mothering can be a deeply beautiful role, it can also become distorted by self-negation. The many-breasted mother ends up caring for an array of children, including projects, needs, groups, and persons that may not even belong at her breast. I remembered a verse I'd scrawled once when my children were small and I was feeling engulfed by the role of mother. Priestess of dutiful sacrament, you knead your soul into bread. You serve it on a silver tray, bright morsels for your family to eat. Aren't you hungry too? Even as my children grew and became teens, many times my role as nurturer allowed the very essence of my life to be overrun and eaten away. Sadly, I know women who keep doing this even after their children have grown and left home. When my many-breasted mother really kicked in, I even found myself taking care of my husband. I would be sure he ate well, encourage him to exercise, make sure he had a shirt ironed for his meeting, table my issues to soothe his bad mood. Women have been trained to be deeply relational creatures, with permeable boundaries, which make us vulnerable to the needs of others. This permeability, this compelling need to connect, is one of our greatest gifts, but without balance it can mean living out the role of the servant who nurtures at the cost of herself. Referring to this feminine script in her essay Professions for Women, Virginia Woolf describes the syndrome and offers a drastic remedy. She was intensely sympathetic. She was immensely charming. She was utterly unselfish. She excelled in the difficult arts of family life. She sacrificed herself daily. If there was chicken, she took the leg. If there was a draft, she sat in it. In short, she was so constituted that she never had a mind or wish of her own, but preferred to sympathize always with the minds and wishes of others. I did my best to kill her. My excuse, if I were to be had up in a court of law, would be that I acted in self-defense. Had I not killed her, she would have killed me. At the very least, we need to disempower this part of ourselves, to relieve ourselves of the internal drive to forfeit our souls as food for others. The Favored Daughter. One of the more uncomfortable discoveries I made about myself during this time was a need to prove myself to the father world, my own father, the cultural father, the church father, the powerful male presence. I began to recognize how important it was to me that he be aware of my accomplishments. The need surfaced from a deep place in my feminine wound. I'd grown up the firstborn in a field of bright athletic brothers, unconsciously trying to convince everyone that being a girl was every bit as worthy. Certainly no one ever said to me that girlhood was less valuable. I simply picked it up by virtue of being female on the planet, and I set out to prove it wrong. I tried through a blaze of achievement, A's on the report card, school honors, swimming trophies, cheerleading trophies, church awards. I did it through compliance. I did it by being everything I imagined a good girl should be. It had been a core pattern of my life, this attempt to be a favored daughter. Favored daughters are women who, carrying the wound of feminine inferiority, try to make up for it by seeking the blessing of the cultural father. Through accomplishments and perfectionism, we hope to atone for the original sin of being born female. We are hoping that Father God will finally see our worth. Even as an adult woman, I'd set up perfectionist standards, which kept me striving. I pursued a thin body, happy children, an impressive speech, and a perfectly written article with determination to succeed, but also with an internal voice that led me to feel whatever I did wasn't quite enough. I worried about not measuring up. Herein lies the torment of it. Favored daughters strive for their worth, piling up external validations, but inside they are most often plagued by self-doubt, wondering if their work or their efforts are good enough. I met a favored daughter at a conference in Atlanta. A successful businesswoman, she told me her story one afternoon over coffee. "All my life, I've been internally driven to succeed at things," she said, "even things that don't matter all that much. I had to be a star at everything. When I finally asked myself why, what came to me was the time my father took me to a Braves baseball game. I got the chance only because my brother was sick that day. I was a daydreamy girl who didn't care much for baseball, but I tried to like it to make my father happy. He loved the game almost irrationally, and he loved my brother the same way, I think, because he was a boy. My father loved me too, but he didn't value me the way he did my brother. I always had the feeling that if I'd been a boy, he would have loved me in that same irrational way. Suddenly, her eyes grew teary. She said, "That day at the ballpark, I was looking up at the sky, counting the clouds, which was this thing I did. And here comes a foul ball flying into the stands, landing right at my feet. I was so lost in the clouds I didn't hear my father shouting at me to pick up the ball. By the time I realized what was happening, someone else had grabbed it. What I remember most is my father's reaction. He said, 'Geez, you girls, you think your brother would have lost the ball like that?' I've spent my whole life since trying hard not to drop the ball, trying to make it up to my father for being nothing but a girl, hoping I could finally get him to prize me like he did my brother. The crazy thing is, I have this 19-page resume, but still there's a voice inside telling me I'm going to mess up." I didn't know what to say to her except that I understood that undoubtedly we were looking for validation in the wrong place, that we needed to quit trying and go recover the primacy of our feminine souls. Then maybe our sense of worth and confidence as women in the world would flow to us fully and naturally. I've met so many of these women, heard so many stories like this. They are all different, and yet they are all the same. In every one, the woman is sitting in the bleacher, or the pew, the school desk, whatever, just being her girl self, when the moment of truth descends kerplunk at her feet. That in this family, this church, this culture, female is the less prized gender. She starts to feel that her gender has somehow dropped the ball, and without even being aware of what she's doing, she may try to make up for it by going through life trying to win love, validation, and esteem from the father world. The Silent Woman. Throughout all this unnaming I was doing, I kept thinking back to the sketches I'd drawn of the mouthless woman. I knew they were attempts to capture the pattern of the silent woman in myself. I began to reflect on the ways I'd withheld my opinions, muzzled disconcerting truths, refrained from expressing my true feelings, squelched my riskier ideas, or thwarted my creativity. When I did that, I was living out the script of the silent woman. Being a silent woman is not about being quiet and reticent. It's about stifling our truth, our real truth. I wondered, had silence encroached as I internalized the message of inferiority? Had I learned that silence was a safe place? Some of the scripting concerning silence has come from the church, from Bible verses like this one. "Let a woman learn in silence, with all submissiveness." 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 11, Revised Standard Version. We may not claim this verse as a guiding principle, but it's there inside us nonetheless. Overall, women's voices have not been encouraged unless they spoke as mouthpieces for the party line. Quiet ladies who held their tongues were loved and lauded. Uppity pioneering women who spoke their minds and said bold things were attacked and sanctioned. And that plays into our greatest fear, which is going against convention and having love and approval taken away, says writer Erica Jong. Very often, silence becomes the female drug of choice. I grew aware that while I spoke a lot, much of the time my deepest words, my outrage, the voice of my feminine soul, were silent. For the first time I began to feel the confinement of my creative voice. There were things I wanted to say, needed to say, yet they didn't lie within the boundaries of Christian writing. In Gail Godwin's novel, A Southern Family, one of her characters, a writer, wonders if she writes, "to satisfy the tastes of the culture that shaped me." Now I wondered, had I? Where had I hedged, pulled back, or diluted my truth? As I reflected on these questions, I stumbled by chance upon the Greek myth of Philomela. It is the story behind the silent woman, and it goes like this. While traveling to see her sister, Philomela was raped by her brother-in-law, Tyrius. Outraged, she threatened to tell her sister and the world what he'd done to her. He responded by cutting out her tongue and banishing her to a guarded tower where she was forced to live in silence. Eventually, though, she seemed to know that if she continued to be silent, she would die. So Philomela began to weave a series of tapestries that became her voice and told her story. She then enlisted an old woman to take them to her sister, who came and liberated her. The myth is about the loss of women's voices. It suggests that the source of female silence is the rape of the feminine, the devaluation and violation of femaleness. It suggests that when women protest this violation, their voices are frequently squelched through ridicule, sanction, and fear of reprisal. In the public arena, at church, work, and home, women's tongues are often silenced when we dare to speak our anger, truths, and visions. In 1993, the councils of churches in the Twin Cities in Minnesota sponsored a reimagining conference. I didn't attend, but I read about the multiplicity of women's voices that were raised there, expressing women's truths, imagining bold feminine images of God, and presenting new challenges to the church. I also read dozens of editorials and letters to denominational papers by church traditionalists who reacted to these voices by castigating, repudiating, and calling for denunciation, full-scale church inquiries, and resignations. Poet Muriel Rukeyser writes, "What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open." Today, the world is starting to split open with women's truths. The fear of voicing ourselves still runs deep, but women are still weaving their truths into a tapestry of stories and sending them out into the world. In the end, speaking out would become the cure for my feminine silence. It would not necessarily banish my fear and reluctance, but I would learn to voice my soul in spite of it, to speak as if my life depended on it. Forming a feminist critique. By now, more than a year had passed since my dream of giving birth to myself. I went about my routine, writing, being mother to my teenage children, seeing friends, jogging, reading a lot, painting a little, serving on an occasional committee, going methodically to church, and through it all, keeping my awakening mostly secret. Part of it was because I was afraid of the response I might get. But secluding my experience during that early period was both cowardly and wise. Some things are too fragile, too vulnerable to bring into the public eye. Tender things with tiny roots tend to wither in the glare of public scrutiny. By holding my awakening within, I contained the energy of it, and it fed me the way blood feeds muscle. It fed me a certain propelling energy, and I kept moving forward. I had finally told myself the truth about the presence of the feminine wound and the way I'd adapted to it. Now I began to tell myself the truth about how this wound came to be inflicted. I began to form what I called my feminist critique. Forming a critique is essential to the birth and development of a spiritual feminist consciousness. Until a woman is willing to set aside her unquestioned loyalty and look critically at the tradition and convention of her faith, her awakening will never fully emerge. The extent of her healing, autonomy, and power is related to the depth of the critique she is able to integrate into her life. As I formed my critique, I came face to face with a system of social governance, a vast complex of patterns and attitudes within culture, religion, and family. The name of the system is patriarchy. It's important to emphasize that patriarchy is neither men nor the masculine principle. It is rather a system in which that principle has become distorted. The word patriarchy comes from the Greek word pater, which means father, and archein, which means rule. It has come to mean a way of social organization marked by the authority or supremacy of men and fathers. Western civilization has been organized this way since its prehistory, though patriarchy is now showing signs of real demise. Learning to see patriarchy, not as I was conditioned to see it, but as it actually is, a wounder of women and feminine life, was not easy. One reason is that since patriarchy is so pervasive and familiar, it becomes invisible. Psychotherapist Anne Wilson Schaaf compares living in patriarchy to living in polluted air. When you are in the middle of pollution, you are usually unaware of it. You eat in it, sleep in it, work in it, and sooner or later start believing that is just the way the air is, she writes. In a similar way, we've accepted the widespread attitudes and effects of patriarchy as givens. They are so much a part of the world, we start to think that's just the way reality is. In the play, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, a deceptively wise bag lady named Trudy mutters, "What is reality anyway? Nothing but a collective hunch." Far from being the sole reality, patriarchy is actually nothing but a collective hunch. For women, making this fine distinction, that it is only one way of viewing reality and not reality itself, is crucial in helping us see patriarchy clearly. The hierarchy. As I began to observe the patriarchal world around me with more clarity, one of the first things I noticed was a principle that seemed to lie at the very heart of it. Life is a hierarchy with men and so-called masculine values at the top. The hierarchy goes like this. At the top, God, then men, then women, children, animals, plants, and minerals. Of course, there are also hierarchies within hierarchies, as we consider issues of race, culture, and economic status. Embedded in the human psyche, this hierarchical view has been passed on as the natural and divinely created order of life. Once I perceived the truth of this, I began to see how subtly and not so subtly hierarchies were ingrained in church, family, marriage, workplaces, politics, and all kinds of systems of thought. With men at the top, or at least with a sense of entitlement about being at top, and women below, or at least with a sense of belonging below, a way of relating was put into place based on dominance and dependence. The role of the one above was to dominate and oversee the ones below. The role of the one below was to answer to and depend on the one above. In addition, the one above learned how to protect his prestigious place at the top. He learned to stay up by keeping her down, that is, by insisting she be content with things as they are. Theologian Anne E. Carr relates that this hierarchy issues forth in a whole series of unequal power relations. God as Father rules over the world, holy fathers rule over the church, clergy fathers over laity, males over females, husbands over wives and children, men over the created world. The pattern even extends to our relationship to nature and how countries seek dominance over each other. I was intrigued with an exercise Anne Wilson Schaaf performed with mixed gender groups. She asked them to list on one half of a sheet of paper the characteristics of God, and on the other half, the characteristics of humans. Invariably, the list for God was omnipotent, all-powerful, omniscient, all-knowing, omnipresent, and eternal. The list for humans typically read childlike, sinful, weak, stupid, and mortal. At this point, the exercise got more interesting. On a different sheet of paper, she asked the group to list characteristics of males on one half and females on the other. The consensus list for male was intelligent, powerful, brave, good, strong. The list for female fell into this general pattern: emotional, weak, fearful, sinful, dependent. When Wilson Schaaf asked the group to set all four lists side by side, they were surprised but had to conclude that according to their perceptions, male is to female as God is to humans. The Great Imbalance. One of the more destructive consequences this hierarchy sets in motion is a pattern of imbalanced valuing in which the masculine is valued over the feminine. That autumn, as I looked at the world with new eyes, asked new questions, and thought new thoughts, I was also reading new books. While reading feminist culture critic Elizabeth Dodson Gray's work, I was struck by her definition of patriarchy as a culture that is slanted so that men are valued a lot and women are valued less, or in which men's prestige is up and women's prestige is down. She followed her definition with a story about Margaret Mead. When Mead journeyed from tribe to tribe on her anthropological studies, she stumbled upon a discovery. It did not matter what work was done in a particular tribe, but rather who did it. If weaving was done in one tribe by men, it was considered a high-prestige occupation. 20 miles away, if weaving was done in a different tribe by women, it had low prestige. The anecdote reminded me of a story a woman told about the time she tried to introduce a novel idea to a church committee where she was the only female member. She insisted the idea would save the church money. "It's unreasonable," she was told. "You just don't understand the way the real world works." After she rotated off the committee, a new male member came on and presented the identical idea. It was resoundingly adopted. One wonders if perhaps it was not what was said, but who said it. Head over heart. I also began to notice that the imbalance of valuing was not confined to actual men and women. People also placed a greater value on men's experience or things associated with the masculine than on women's experience or things associated with the feminine. A large amount of women's experience has been concentrated in nurturing roles, in matters of relationship. As we evolved these skills, we even came to carry or reflect relational nurturing values for the culture at large. Likewise, men's traditional focus of experience in the public arena has conditioned them toward the values prized in that sphere: autonomy, reason, individuality, and competitiveness. That women are connected with matters of heart and men with matters of head are distinctions entrenched in our culture, psyches, myths, and symbols. In fact, psychologists Jean Baker Miller, Carol Gilligan, and others have documented that certain differences do exist in the way men and women relate, know, and make moral choices. Gilligan found, for instance, that girls tend to relate from a web model, preferring interconnections and the centrality of relationships. Boys tend to relate from a hierarchical model that prefers autonomy, individualism, and competition. Some of these differences may be due to biology, but much of it has come through historical conditioning. My personal belief is that while differences exist, women and men both have an innate and equal ability to engage in the full range of human experiences. Men can nurture and women can quest for autonomy. Neither men nor women should be limited to a narrow category of what's considered feminine if you're female or masculine if you're male. I also believe that men and women contain both masculine and feminine qualities and that the goal is to balance, blend, and honor both within the individual and the culture. The point, however, is that women have been socialized toward certain choices and experiences, and these experiences need to be valued in a way that is not inferior to men's experiences. Indeed, as I made my critique, the problem seemed to me not that there are differences, but rather how we value these differences. It seemed clear that patriarchy has valued rationality, independence, competitiveness, efficiency, stoicism, mechanical forms, and militarism, things traditionally associated with the masculine. Less valued are beingness, feeling, art, listening, intuition, nurturing, and attachment, things traditionally associated with the feminine. As a patriarchal institution, Christianity has tended to value masculine attributes more than those connected with the feminine. Author Margaret Starbird put it succinctly: "Institutional Christianity, which has nurtured Western civilization for nearly 2,000 years, may have been built over a gigantic flaw in doctrine, a theological San Andreas fault, the denial of the feminine." Often competitiveness, logic, objectivity, and matters of the head have found preeminence over concerns with inclusiveness, relatedness, or matters of the heart. I recognized the imbalance in the way dogma, theological rightness, triumph of the Christian way, oratorical sermons, church business, nationalism, individual pursuit, conversion figures, and breaking scripture down into its various hermeneutics have frequently been valued over feelings, tears, peace, gentleness, group consciousness, and gathering humanity together as a family. I tried to picture a culture where the valuing was equal. In my wilder moments, I imagined a society that paid childcare workers, teachers, homeless advocates, poets, and bird watchers as much as it paid professional football players, generals, and corporate CEOs. I tried to imagine a church where it mattered less what your beliefs and practices were, and more how relationships were nurtured and healed. I tried to imagine a church that did not support its country's wars as a matter of patriotic course, and instead stood against the devastation and suffering they caused in people's lives. One day I spotted an elderly white-haired woman wearing a T-shirt that read, "What if the military had to have bake sales to raise money, and the PTA got the Pentagon budget?" I walked over and told her how wonderful it was, her wearing a shirt like that. She laughed and said, "Some people have called me subversive for wearing it, but I don't care. One day we may owe our survival to subversive women." I decided maybe it was a good thing to be subversive when it comes to the heart. One night, as Anne and I watched a video of The Wizard of Oz, I realized that the Tin Man character, at least in the early part of the movie, seemed an apt symbol of patriarchal consciousness. He is a frozen figure, standing with his axe, his blade of power, in the air. The story tells us he's lost his heart. He's lost the juices of life. Even his tears are frozen on his face. His ability to feel and relate at a deep empathetic level is gone. Have you ever wondered how the Tin Man got into such a deplorable, frozen state? The book says the Tin Man was a woodsman whose axe became cursed, causing him to cut away his own body piece by piece, including his heart, until he was no longer covered in warm flesh, but encased in an armor of tin. Through our lopsided valuing, we have come to labor under a cursed axe, under a patriarchal system that has cut away the body, including the heart, replacing it with technological tin. And like the Tin Man, we find ourselves trapped in our own heartlessness. Spirit over nature. I also began to recognize another imbalance in the values that women and men carry for society. For thousands of years, the feminine has been deeply associated with the body, flesh, sensuality, earth, and nature, while the masculine has been associated with spirit, heaven, and transcendence over nature. Actually, men are no more connected to spirit than women, and women no more connected to nature than men. The perception may have arisen from women's closeness to fertility, procreation, and the rhythms of nature. Women are tied to these cycles in a way men are not. Women go through the monthly cycle of menstruation, just as the moon goes through a monthly cycle of waxing and waning. Through pregnancy, childbirth, and nursing, we grow life inside our bodies, deliver life through our bodies, and feed life from our bodies. It has also been left to women to care for other bodies, tending the young, sick, and dying. For these reasons, perhaps, women have represented flesh and embodied the earthly, and in doing so, we've come to be identified with nature. Conversely, nature is thought of as feminine. We speak of Mother Earth and virgin forests. The connection is even entwined in the roots of our language. The word mother comes from the Latin word mater, which means matter. Mother and matter are both the stuff out of which everything is composed. As I contemplated this profound connection, once again it became apparent to me which of the two polarities, nature, earth, or spirit, heaven, was more valued. Both women and earth have been abused, raped, and disregarded. The man's comment about my daughter in the drugstore, "That's how I like to see a woman, on her knees," is not fundamentally different from a comment I've heard attributed to Francis Bacon, one of the fathers of the Age of Reason. Purportedly, he said that the earth was a harlot and must be controlled. In other words, "That's how I like to see Mother Earth, on her knees." In its flight from and fear of the feminine, the church has failed to waken to its ecological self, a term author Joanna Macy uses to describe one who has conquered the personal ego and knows that she or he is not separate from anything else. An awakened ecological self is someone like John Seed, director of the Rainforest Information Center, who says, "I try to remember that it's not me, John Seed, trying to protect the rainforest. Rather, I am part of the rainforest, protecting myself." This awakened self has been largely absent from the Christian tradition. In Christianity, there is a deeply embedded separation between spirit and nature, a split apparent in this verse from Galatians chapter 5, verse 17, "The desires of the flesh are against the spirit, and the desires of the spirit are against the flesh, for these are opposed to each other," Revised Standard Version. Patriarchy has viewed the earth as a fallen creation and matter as inherently evil, and Christians have used and misused scriptures to drive the wedge deeper into the human psyche. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world is not of the Father.